Should old acquaintance be forgot? Not a chance.
I would like to speak directly to the people and leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Nowruz is just one part of your great and celebrated culture. Over many centuries, your art, your music, literature, and innovation have made the world a better and more beautiful place.
On the same evening he goes on The Tonight Show, the president wishes the people of Iran a Happy New Year. The internet video message for the holiday of Nowruz called for closer cooperation and a rejection of violence and the support of terrorism.
Thank you. And Eid e Shoma Mubarak.
Talks with Iran. YouTube diplomacy on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, March 20th. It's spring. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who has a new baby and spending time with that little wee one. Coming up this hour, a cautionary tale from abroad on avoiding economic depression, and we'll find out if wolves are delicious. All that and more, but first, your headlines.
President Obama became the first sitting president to do a late-night comedy show with Jay Leno last night. He went for laughs, but also got serious about the economy.
Ultimately, I'm now the guy who's responsible to fix it. Right. And one of the things that I'm trying to break is a pattern in Washington where everybody's always looking for somebody else to blame.
Leno can blame the president for helping his career. As we mentioned earlier, the president is making a case directly to Iran's people for a new kind of relationship. The video message praises Iran's long history but criticizes its current leadership. This comes as Iranians celebrate Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
And Iran's eastern neighbor is Afghanistan, where U.S. forces and local troops have been in brutal fights with militants. The Pentagon reports more than 30 militants died in 2 days of combat in various parts of the country. And in neighboring Pakistan, security forces are on the hunt for attackers of a base in the country's dangerous northwest. Rocket attacks killed 10 people, injured dozens more. Pakistan suspects Taliban fighters in the strikes.
The hammering continues, but it doesn't have anything to do with housing starts. Congress is still after the AIG bonuses. A House bill to hyper-tax them passed easily yesterday. The bill Republicans voted on a split ticket. Either they had to vote for a new tax or miss a chance to whack AIG. It was a tough choice. GOP House Leader John Boehner voted no.
Do we have to have this political charade of bringing this bill out here? I don't think so. I think this is a bad bill with bad consequences. We didn't see the bill until last night.
Well, bad or not, AIG is still front and center in Congress. The Senate has a similar bill using taxes to wipe out the bonuses. It should move ahead next week. The S&P and the Dow slipped more than 1% as Congress wrangled over AIG. The Dow starts trading at 7,400. The S&P begins at 784. Kind of a different conversation we're having on the program today. We're going to be talking about one family's challenges in finding a healthy sex life for their disabled son, who's 21 and headed out into the world. So here's the question. What's more important, companionship or a physical relationship? And sex or companionship, how does that change as your life goes on?
I think there's an age-related issue here, and the issue is that when you're young, it's probably more important to have a physical connection, and when you're older, companionship becomes more important.
Well, let's hear from some young people then, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Yeah. We do want to hear from you. And you know what? Honesty is beautiful.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Call them bilateral discussions with the people of Iran without precondition. You might call them that. But it was a video address posted on the White House website and broadcast into Iran to mark the Iranian New Year holiday of Nowruz that made the news this morning.
We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
a direct message by video and internet to the people and leadership of Iran. How significant is that? Iran has already been invited to a multilateral meeting to talk about Afghanistan. The question is, does this address represent one in a series of changes that may be going on between the United States and Iran? Joining us to talk about that is Sadek Zibakalem, who's a political science professor at Tehran University. He joins us from Tehran. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. So first of all, who saw this address? The proliferation of internet connections inside Iran certainly makes it more likely that a president of the United States is going to actually connect with the people of Iran than in the past.
Well, I think it is, to begin with, Obama has made a radical departure from Bush and, for that matter, other U.S. presidents, because they always try to sort of split or to differentiate between the Iranian people on the one hand and the Islamic regime on the other hand. Now, for the first time, we have a U.S. president which actually hasn't tried to separate between Iranian on the one hand and the Islamic regime on the other. I mean, that in itself is a new development.
It's very interesting. I mean, the language was very specific. He didn't just say, I want to talk to the people of Iran, forget the government, I want to talk to the people of Iran and its leaders. What do you think young people in Iran are curious about regarding the U.S. president, Professor?
Well, actually, since Obama was elected, there has been a lot of hope and expectations, particularly with regard to younger generation Iranians. I mean, the what we call them in Iran, the post-Islamic Revolution generation, because they have been brought up in the atmosphere of complete animosity between Tehran and Washington. So they are expecting that Obama and the fact that he has been somewhat different from the other U.S. president might be able to break the ice with the Islamic leaders. And there would be some changes.
Okay, Professor, last question. Does this put pressure on President Ahmadinejad, or is he likely to take credit for some warming in relations? What happens now?
I think Ahmadinejad and other hardliners would try to manipulate and actually to take a stock of Obama's speech and saying that he is admitting that we have been right all along and so on and so forth. But underlying factor is that I think sooner or later they have to come out and they have to respond to Obama's the olive branch.
Well said, Professor. At the very least, it appears on some rhetorical level, the leaders of Iran are on the defensive because of this series of initiatives by Barack Obama. Sadek Zibakalem, political science professor at Tehran University, reacting to the message for Nowruz from the president last night. Fry?
Thanks, John. And we've also been following so much financial news. We want to know, what does it mean when the mother of all banks, the U.S. Treasury, essentially pulls money out of thin air? Some analysts argue that's exactly what happened with the federal bank's latest move to pump $1 trillion into the economy. Now with us to take a look at this, we've got Dan Gross, senior editor for Newsweek and columnist for Slate. How are you?
I'm good. I'm here at the WSHU studios in Fairfield, Connecticut, where after I leave, I'm going to go set up a pitchfork stand.
Because of AIG. That's great.
The mobs are looking for pitchforks and tar and feathers along the Merritt Parkway.
You've got this book, Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. I will, you know, just leave that there as a context for your remarks. But I want you to be really simple, because it has taken, you know, every ounce of strength I have to try to understand what's going on here. So the Fed is buying mortgage-backed securities and treasury debt. Does this mean that banks are going to start lending money, like actually lending money to people and businesses again?
Not necessarily. Think about it this way. The Federal Reserve has absolute control over the shortest of short-term interest rates. It basically says, you know, we control the rate at which banks lend to one another. That's the federal funds rate. You know, when they come out every 6 weeks or so, they manipulate that, helps put money into the economy. Those are short-term rates. It's already cut that rate down to basically zero. It can't do anything more. Now, long-term rates, which are what long-term bonds and mortgages are based on, are dictated by the market, people buying and selling bonds in these global markets. The Fed cannot control those. It can't simply decree the rate on the 10-year bond shall be X. But what it can do, what it just did, is announce we are going to be buying hundreds of billions of dollars of Treasury bonds and bonds backed by mortgages issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. When a huge buyer like that comes in, it pushes the prices of those bonds up and pushes the yields, which is to say the interest rates, down. And so this is a way of the Federal Reserve saying we are going to use our sort of force to push down long-term interest rates. So you saw the yield on the 10-year bond go from 2.9, which is already quite low, down to 2.6 in the wake of that announcement.
Okay, Dan, let's talk business models for 1 second. It looks as though you can get money for 2.5% interest if you're a bank, and you can lend it to credit deadbeats like me for 8%. That's a good business, isn't it?
Well, right now it's only the government that can get it at 2.5%. Banks and other financial institutions have to pay something more. That's the spread, the difference between what investors are willing to accept from the government, which so far always pays back its debts, to what they're willing to accept from companies who don't always pay back their debts is higher. But so, yeah, companies may have to be paying 5 or 6 or 7%. That part of the market still hasn't sorted out. Now, the government has guaranteed a lot of debt issued by financial companies, so they are going to be able to take advantage of these lower debts. And the best part of this is we have these massive deficits, as you referenced. We are going to be selling, the taxpayers, hundreds of billions of dollars of debt in the next many months, long-term debt. So we are going to be able to sell it at this very and lock in these very low interest rates.
What does it mean when you say the taxpayers are going to be able to sell the debt? I mean, I mean by that is taxpayers pay taxes, and we do have a representative government, and we do have some power over who we choose to make decisions, but it's not as if I get a direct vote in this. So explain to me.
We're running these massive deficits to finance the stimulus and the bailout. How do we finance this? How does the government finance it? It sells bonds to the public and then has to pay interest on those. And all things considered, better to pay a 2.5 or 2.6% rate on that debt than it is to pay a 3, 4, or 5% rate on that debt. So there is this kind of feedback loop here where the Federal Reserve says we're going to buy all this stuff, push rates down, and the government says, okay, now we're going to issue a lot of this debt and lock in these long-term rates.
Which is where the printing press idea comes in, that at some point you can't just have this loop of imaginary money. At some point you actually have to print $100 bills with Ben Franklin on the front?
At the end of the day, yes. Well, now we basically print it electronically. And, of course, this is the fear, the long-term fear, is that by essentially creating money, the Fed says, we are going to buy all these bonds. How do they do it? They essentially create money. People sell bonds to the Fed. The Fed credits their account with cash. That's how the Federal Reserve creates money. That putting all those dollars into circulation ultimately hurts the value of the dollar and may lead to inflation. And you see that is the sort of longer-term concern here.
Speaking of longer-term concerns, very quickly, is it true that today's children will be in hock for stuff that they didn't even get to make decisions about? Just briefly.
Well, I think that was already the case. Look, in the last decade, our federal debt went from about $5 trillion in 2000 to almost $10 trillion at the beginning of this year. This is before the TARP or the bailout or any of this stuff. And now we're looking at $12 trillion. So, yes, we were already in hock to a large degree, and they will be in the future.
Okay, Dan, thanks so much. Dan Gross is the author of Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. Ouch.
Our grandchildren will certainly know much more about the number trillion, or maybe even quadrillion by then.
If they still can afford pencils and paper.
Yeah. Well, the numbers. They can study the numbers without spending a lot of money, that's for sure.
That's why God invented rocks. Mm.
And zeros.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, a mom tries to help her son find a healthy sexual relationship and companionship. What kind of a mom is that? It's for her disabled son, and it's an interesting conversation coming up. Lucy writes to us, "I believe that a caring, loving companionship is most important. I, too, have a disabled son who is a wonderful, kind human being. I would love to find a partner for him who can be as loving. He does have interests in girls, but they are more disabled than he is as far as behavior goes. He is a good person." Which is better, companionship or a physical relationship? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Fry?
Thanks, John. Going back to economics, by the 1980s, Japan was the world's second largest economy, and made in Japan was synonymous with the best of everything from cars to electronics. Movies like the 93 Sean Connery Wesley Snipes thriller Rising Sun betrayed a fear of Japan and Japanese culture that was deeper than just money. But ironically, at the same time that movie was coming out, the Asian financial crisis of the 90s led to a deep and prolonged Japanese recession. Matt Fry became the BBC's Asia correspondent at about that time and found himself covering economic collapse across the region. Today, he hosts BBC World News America. That's an evening news show on BBC America and BBC World News. And Matt is back in Japan looking at what's happening to the economy there now. Matt has been covering something I find fascinating, a local phenomenon, cyber cafe homeless. He spoke to us earlier in the morning from Tokyo, and I asked Matt to explain the term.
Well, what basically happens and has happened in Japan is that the economic crisis here, which has, by the way, been grinding on since 1990, so these guys are in it for the long haul. They know what they're talking about when we talk about crisis, has produced an increasing number of homeless people. In Japan, housing is very expensive because of the limited space, especially in places like Tokyo. So once you lose your job, unless you have a family that you can call upon or you can move in with your mum and dad, you're basically out on the street. Now, being homeless on the street is basically engaging in a kind of downward spiral of misery that means you become lodged in the permanent margins of society. And the cyber cafes across this country provide an interesting alternative. They're a lot cheaper than the cheapest hotel. They're an awful lot cheaper than the cheapest apartment, but obviously they cost a little bit more than just sleeping on the street, and they're more respectable because you've got a roof over your head. So in this particular cyber cafe, instead of just going in to kind of log onto your computer for an hour and have a glass of green tea and listen to some funky music, you move in with the belongings that you have left, with your sleeping bag and your blanket, and then they give you a coffin-sized room separated from the next coffin-sized room by a paper-thin wall, and then you live there. And this cyber cafe, you know, on one hand, it had kind of very kind of nice jazz music, and there were computers, but there was also a microwave and a shower room and several bathrooms, and then you could hear the sound of snoring and coughing and wheezing, and these people were living in these booths, their shoes, of course, displayed Japanese style out front, you know, so you only walk around inside with slippers, and the thing that was really sad was that although these people had found something that was better than sleeping on the street, and although they shared the same plight, which is that they'd all been made redundant by their various companies, none of them actually talked to each other. They were locked in this prison of profound, intimate shame in a place where there was no privacy. So, had this been America or Britain, they would have all been sharing, you know, dirty jokes and experiences, and they would have just become one big dysfunctional family with rows and fights and all the rest of it. But this place was completely silent, and they all stayed in their little booths, not communicating with each other. It was a really sad place to be.
So, Matt, is that to say that the Japanese are having difficulty getting beyond the shame and getting into a, all right, we're going to get through this, here's how we're going to do it, we're going to improvise, that the living in the cyber cafe isn't viewed as any sort of coping, improvising, we're going to get through this sort of mechanism?
You know, it's so interesting you should say that, John, because, you know, in America is a you know, even at the moment, America is a pretty aspirational, optimistic society. You know, the glass is always half full rather than half empty. You know, from the president down to, you know, to just about everyone you meet, there's a sense of we can get through this, America is better than this. Even if it doesn't end up being true, that's the kind of stuff that people like to say and like to believe in. In this country, despite the fact that this crisis, you know, has really started in 1991 when the bubble first burst, despite that, there's an extraordinary blanket of denial about what's going on. I was interviewed by an extremely famous Japanese, the kind of the Lou Dobbs of Japan, although, you know, instead of being Lou Dobbs, she was a very attractive 45-year-old woman. But she has this incredibly popular show on Japanese television. And she really took offense to my cyber cafe story. And on air was basically attacking me for just picking out, you know, these homeless stories and misrepresenting Japan. And I said, listen, this country has just lost 50% of its export market. Your economy is going to shrink by 6%, which is twice as much as the United States and even more than Britain, which is a bit of a basket case at the moment. You have got enormous problems, and the ranks of the unemployed are swelling, as indeed are the ranks of the homeless people. You cannot deny that this problem exists, but they find that kind of shameful.
Shame not limited to one nation alone, however. Matt Fry, host of BBC World News America on the BBC America cable station, joined us from Tokyo for that interview conducted earlier this morning. And now we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thanks, Fry. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Former AIG chief Hank Greenberg denies the company had the kind of retention bonuses that are now under fire. Greenberg spoke on CBS's early show today. His comments come a day after the House approved a bill to impose a heavy tax on bonuses of employees who work at companies who take federal aid. The Senate has confirmed the nation's first female Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, is currently Dean of Harvard Law School. She will have the job of representing the U.S. before the Supreme Court. President Obama has taken an unusual step today and appeals to Iranian citizens through a direct video message. The taped message includes Farsi subtitles and is going out on the web and through international broadcasters today. The president also says that the U.S. wants to engage with Iran and end decades of hostility. Now, there has been some reaction from Iranians to the president's video message. And for those reactions, I went to the BBC's email box. Hamid says that he welcomes Mr. Obama's message. It could be a real new expansion of a relationship frozen for too long. And Reza says the Iranian government must consider this new beginning with the U.S., but I am sure they wouldn't do that because they will lose power in Iran. And today, coincidentally, is the start of the Persian holiday Nowruz, which celebrates spring and new beginning. Staying with some international stories, more than 30 militants have been killed in Afghanistan after 2 days of clashes. The troops were patrolling in a militant-heavy area when they were attacked by gunfire and returned fire. And we're now almost 1 hour into the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere.
Which is different from Nowruz.
It is.
Right.
But Nowruz starts at the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
So Nowruz is New Year, and today is springtime for the Northern Hemisphere and also autumn for the Southern Hemisphere.
Do you get Nowruz fever every year, Femi?
Sometimes I do.
Oh, you too. I see.
Yeah.
Thank you, Femi.
Try not to talk about it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Later on in the show, we're going to talk to a family who is dealing with a challenge. There's a son, 21 years old, who is disabled and seeking a healthy sex life and a relationship. That got us thinking, what's more important, companionship or physical relationship? And how does that change as your life goes on? We're getting some reactions.
being a person with a disability, that does affect the physical intimacy of a relationship. Being able to have good, healthy sex and have good companionship is ideal. I'm married, been married 9 years. There are many of us who have to figure out ways to be able to have a healthy relationship with different physical intimacies rather than what the society thinks of as good, healthy sex.
Well, that's an important story, and we want to hear yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Interesting stuff. They are responding. I would not have thought of it. But anyway, in the studio here is the love of my life, Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer. And it's fair to say, Melissa, that we value companionship more than a physical relationship. Isn't that strictly correct?
Well, companionship with food, for sure.
Right. Yes. I'm down with that.
So let's talk about a book title, all right? How to Cook a Wolf. If a wolf was around and it was the only thing you had to eat, you would not want to buy this book. But if a wolf was at your door, in the sense that hard times were peering at you through the window in your kitchen as you look in your cupboard and say, what can we cook tonight? What can I afford to cook tonight? In hard times, the brilliant writer M.F.K. Fisher wrote this book in 1942, How to Cook a Wolf. And it's all about making sure that there's adventure in your kitchen, even if there's not a lot of money in the wallet. And Melissa Clark is here to talk about it. And, of course, she's brought some cake. How important is this book, Melissa, and what was it like to pick up today as opposed to the 1940s?
Well, the reason I picked it up today is because there is a wolf at all of our doors. You know, we can't afford to go out to eat as much as we have been. And everyone, I think, is wanting to cook at home, whether they know how to cook or whether they're just learning. Everyone is going shopping and they're buying ingredients and trying to figure out what to do with it. And that's what I thought, well, let me see what M.F.K. Fisher had to say about a very similar time. A little background, she wrote this book, like you said, in 1942. It was World War II.
Food rationing,
but she had just come out of the Great Depression. So she had had a very long period of abstinence, but that didn't stop her from enjoying every single thing she put in her mouth. This woman was a sensualist. She loved to eat, and her whole book is how to take something like seaweed or an egg and make it the most delicious thing you've ever had in your life. And I thought, okay, well, we can apply, you know, we can pick and choose and apply this to now, even if we're not, you know, gathering seaweed from the beach and cooking it.
Let me just interject that one thing that I found fascinating was that guy, is it Jamie Oliver, the Naked Chef, the celebrity chef? He was like, oh, it's too late for Americans. Americans have lost the ability to cook, and so they're going to take their dollars and go to get a McDonald's, you know, dollar meal, and they're never going to.
McDonald's sales are up.
And McDonald's sales are up.
Well, okay,
you know?
I can see that. But I do think that for a great number of people who want to eat healthy food, I mean, that's another thing. People are eating better now. Now that they're not eating out as much, they're actually eating better because they're intimate with their ingredients. They're seeing what they're cooking, so they know what goes into their meals. And I think that's really important. And that's something that M.F.K. Fisher would endorse. She'd say, know your ingredients, embrace them. You know, it's cheaper to buy a whole chicken than cut up chicken parts. And you also have a more, as we're talking about intimacy, a more intimate experience with your meal.
Right.
You're cutting it up and completely engaged in the process of cooking.
You know, let's give you a sense of how this is a combination book. It's partly a DIY, a do-it-yourself cooking manual full of recipes, but it's also this sort of literary invitation to go nuts. How to Catch the Wolf is a chapter title. How to Boil Water is a chapter title. How Not to Boil an Egg. How to Rise Up Like New Bread. How to Be Content with a Vegetable Love. Does this stuff work today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what she's saying, and all of those titles are great examples, she's saying enjoy the process of cooking and then enjoy the process, the fruits of your labor. And that is the most important
thing. All right, so what's a 21st century Melissa Clark lesson drawn directly from the pages of this book?
Okay, like I was talking about the chicken, right? There are ways to economize. You want to go to the supermarket and you want to buy fresh, whole ingredients. The more whole and fresh your ingredient is, the cheaper it's going to be, right? So don't start with grated cheese. Go and buy a beautiful block of cheese and grate it yourself. You get to know the cheese better, and you're saving money right there. For example, chickpeas, right? If you buy dried chickpeas, they're closer to nature. They're closer to the way they started. Cheaper than canned chickpeas. And even if you buy...
Insanely cheaper.
Cheaper.
Yeah.
But even canned chickpeas are cheap. And you know what? They're cheaper than hummus that you buy in the cabinet. Do you know how long it takes to make hummus? About 3 seconds. You dump the chickpeas into your blender, add lemon juice and tahini and salt, and you are there. So there are all these ways. But, I mean, the point here is go out and cook. This is what I'm trying to tell people is go out and cook. Buy something you've never bought before. smell it, taste it, and figure out how to use it. And then that brings us to our cake here.
All right,
this
so
is
I'm
something
I've
you have
some
never
cake.
Had
got
before,
gorgeous cake.
I promise you.
I'm smelling it. And so this is a puzzle?
This is a puzzle.
This is a reward,
this is a challenge
a gift
for
and
you.
A puzzle.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to take a
MFK,
taste here.
This is what MFK says to bake when you don't have eggs and you don't have butter, but you want to bake a
no
cake.
No eggs, no butter.
No eggs, no butter in that cake.
It smells delicious, great spices.
What's
slightly,
the secret ingredient?
There's a secret ingredient in here?
There's a secret ingredient in that cake, and I want you to tell me what it is. No, it's... You want to know? Or you want people to find out on the
well,
web?
Well, there's nuts.
There's nuts,
dates,
figs,
or something. Figs,
raisins.
Yep.
It's delicious.
Tons
it's
of spices.
I can't believe there's
with
no...
So there's no
ingredient.
Eggs?
No eggs.
Can't believe there's
and
no eggs.
No butter.
No, there's
okay,
shortening.
So,
but no, just a little bit. Just a little bit of shortening. But it really
okay,
is,
so what's the secret ingredient
you want to know?
It's not
yep.
sawdust.
Tell
yeah.
me. I can't taste
tomato soup? Can of tomato
oh,
soup?
Wow.
You are kidding.
That's what...
Campbell's tomato soup?
I was like, there must be pumpkin in here, but it's
that's what it tastes like, right? Mary Frances, that's what MFK Fisher was called. She could make the most delicious cake out of a can of tomato soup. And that is why you all need to go out and cook, and you need to buy this book, How to Cook Like a Wolf.
Oh, wow. How to Cook a Wolf. And keep the wolf away from your door with this book and with the advice of Melissa Clark. Thanks, Melissa, New York Times food writer. This cake is delicious. I'm going to tempt Femi Okay with it during the headlines.
Thank you. You're so kind. 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Jay Leno says that having the president on The Tonight Show yesterday was one of the best nights of his life. One of President Obama's Tonight Show jokes, though, has the White House backpedaling. It came in a conversation about the president's bowling ability.
I bowled a 129. Yes, I had. Oh, no, that's very good. Yeah. Oh, that's very good,
sorry,
Mr. President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
Today was like Special Olympics or something.
Yeah,
so
nice. Thanks a lot.
The audience laughed, but the White House later spoke up to say the president did not mean to offend disabled athletes. They said he was just trying to poke fun at his own bowling. Now, apparently on his way back to Washington on Air Force One, the president called the chairman of the Special Olympics, Tim Shriver, to say that he was sorry. And this happened before the show even went out.
Yeah.
Tom Shriver was talking about that this morning on one of the early morning shows. Now, today, the president is contrite, but back to work. He'll be meeting with state lawmakers and officials on stimulus and transportation investments. In international news, the top deputy in a powerful drug cartel has been arrested. Vicente Zambada is now in custody. The arrest is part of a larger crackdown on drug cartels, and President Felipe Calderon has sent thousands of troops to the U.S. border in an effort to take back control. And EU nations pledged today to double the International Monetary Fund's budget to $500 billion and better regulation to ward off future crises as far as the global economy is concerned. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. John, the Treasury is giving auto suppliers a $5 billion boost, but don't call it a bailout. Automakers GM and Chrysler have to decide which suppliers will survive and which ones are going to go under. We have Justin Hyde, the Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press, with us. Welcome back to the show. And what is new and unusual about this plan?
Well, Farai, this plan provides $5 billion that will be funneled through the automakers to their suppliers. It's up to the automakers to decide which suppliers live and which suppliers die with this program. The Treasury was very concerned about getting in the position of being able to pick winners and losers in the industry, and this allows the automakers to pick the most essential parts and make sure that they still have them going forward.
Why shouldn't we think of this as just another bailout, or should we?
Well, I think bailout is something of a loaded term, even back in Detroit. Unlike the financial industry, where if you're qualified, given the state of your finances, you're able to get some federal money, not all suppliers are going to be able to access this fund. It's going to be limited to just those parts which the Detroit automakers feel like they need to keep in production. It's only for things going forward, and the money is a credit line. It's going to have to be paid back by the end of the term.
Are there suppliers who already pretty much know that they have products that are really targeted towards cars and trucks that aren't going to be made anymore and that they are going to have to lay everybody off?
I think that there's probably some of that realization dawning. There are a lot of suppliers who are on the brink. Before this aid was announced, there was one analyst group expecting that it could be 500 bankruptcies in the supplier industry. The production cuts have been so steep that a lot of suppliers were warning big man. Large suppliers. So it's clear that there'll be more consolidation in the industry. The question is who will be the winners and the losers, and that's something that's going to be sussed out over the coming weeks.
So if you're making fuel injectors, you might be comfortable, but if you're making Escalade hood ornaments, you're probably terrified this morning.
Well, now these grants will go to the direct suppliers, so as tier one in the industry. And it's going to be really, it's completely up to the automakers. If they feel that there's another supplier for a part, they might not grant this waiver. If they feel that this supplier is essential and they can't do without them, they'll give them the help.
Justin, what about the possibility? Right now there's, you know, 500,000 people who are employed by auto suppliers. Do you think there's going to be some mavericky new companies that come up with new ways to deliver these products to the car companies faster, better, cheaper? Do you think there's going to be some startups in this game?
It's very hard to find the financing and the capital needed for a startup in something as especially intensive as auto parts manufacturing right now. What's more likely is that you might see some suppliers rolled up. There's been a lot of drive for consolidation in the industry, trying to winnow down the number of players in the field. That process in the past has been more about financial engineering than necessity. You ended up with companies that had a lot of debt and were particularly unsuited to survive the current downturn. The process going forward is going to be a lot more about survival of the fittest than anything else.
All right. Well, Justin Hyde, thank you so much for that. Justin Hyde is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press, and we were talking about what happens to auto suppliers, 500,000 people in that industry, one we don't think about a lot.
You know, it's possible, based on this plan, that the car companies could actually buy parts makers. That sort of consolidation even. It used to be the car companies made all the parts.
Yeah, exactly. Lots to think about.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, a mom's wish for her disabled son. Good sex, companionship, all of the above. Tom writes to us on our website, companionship without intimacy and vice versa is dysfunctional on many levels. They're not mutually exclusive. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now, Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The former boss of AIG is the latest leader to distance himself from the controversial bonuses at the insurance agency. Hank Greenberg says the company didn't have a bonus program for the financial division when he ran it.
We had a bonus plan based on performance. If you didn't perform, there were no bonuses.
Oh, yeah, right.
So.
I believe that.
So that's what Greenberg said this morning.
Malarkey.
Oh, is there an echo in this room?
Excuse me.
That's what Greenberg said this morning on CBS's The Early Show. The current AIG head told Congress that the bonus program preceded him.
Yeah, yeah. Our bonuses were good. Yeah, right. Yeah.
You moving know, on.
I'm going to sit on his deck.
Staying on the same subject. So, John, you might have something more to say here. The House has passed a bill slapping 90% taxes on large bonuses paid to AIG and other firms getting substantial government bailout money. The Senate bill is slightly different, but also uses new tax policy to get the bonus money back. And President Obama is making an unprecedented gesture to Iranians. He's putting out a new video message calling for a new relationship between the U.S. and Iran. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So the most natural thing in the world is for a parent to want their child, as he or she is reaching adulthood, to be happy, to find a mate, to find companionship, to have a healthy sexual life. Lucy and Otto Baxter are faced with those challenges. They're not parents, they're mother and son. And they're speaking to us from Oxford. 21-year-old Otto, what's your mom trying to help you do?
Well, I want a girlfriend.
And what do you want to do
with a girlfriend? I do have a girlfriend. To go out somewhere and have a fantastic day.
Sounds like a great idea, Otto. Certainly leading into the weekend, who wouldn't want to go out with their girlfriend and have a fantastic date? Otto Baxter is a 21-year-old man with Down syndrome. His adoptive mother is Lucy Baxter. Lucy, I heard you helping Otto. You've taken this to a very, very public degree here, actually going on the BBC program World Have Your Say and talking about the importance of finding a girlfriend and especially finding a sexual mate for your 21-year-old son. What's that been like, Lucy?
Well, this whole thing has been a sort of worldwide debate, which is fantastic. And, you know, it really needs to be spoken about because I think people with disabilities have been generally oppressed by the rest of us. And I live with my son and I know how sad he is. He's watched his friends go off and slowly, you know, pair up and he's left behind. And, you know, as a mother, I'm helping him do lots of things, you know, try and get a job, find a career, lots and lots of things. Because he has a learning disability, obviously, you know, I'm probably a bit more involved in his life than a lot of mothers would be. But, you know, this is one aspect of it. So.
Well, I have to say, my mother was never interested in helping me find a girlfriend who would actually go all the way with me, I have to say. So Otto has got that way over me growing up. But Lucy, what is your concern about Otto living independently if he should leave your custody?
Well, I would, you know, I would just like to make sure that he's, you know, all set up to do that. I've always taught him to make very good choices in life and to look at all the, you know, the avenues, all the choices he can make.
And having having a healthy sex life is one of those really important choices for adulthood. And as a mom, you're really concerned about that.
Absolutely, yes. And I'm, you know, he's got a lot of very good friends, very, you know, normal, ordinary friends. And all this is happening to them at the moment, you know, his cousins, everybody. So why not Otto? It's exactly the same for him.
Joining us is Karen Avery, who's Associate Director of Independence First, an independent living center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Karen, this debate is a universal one for parents and their children, but it has certain complexities when you're talking about people with disabilities. How are these debates and conversations had here in the United States, Karen?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that there's a universal debate going on in the United States about it, but certainly within our organization and the folks that I've talked to about this issue, is we're kind of surprised that it's considered different. I guess parents with kids who don't have disabilities struggle with these same issues, and I think that the problem here has more to do with the fact that society tends to view people with disabilities as asexual. They have difficulty really viewing people with disabilities as sexual beings, and so the conversation sort of stops right there.
Lucy, have you found that to be the case in the public reaction to your crusade, your mission?
I have, yes, absolutely. It's been the case for a long time. But, you know, I know, you know, I started out meeting people with learning disabilities because I used to go to a big old Victorian institution. And not that long before I started visiting, the people there used to have dances and all the staff used to stand in the middle of the dance floor. And once the men and the women had done their dance, the men went one side and the women went the other. Now, that's how we've treated these people.
The Victorian era still rules for people with disabilities. We've already got a response from one of our listeners. Listen to this, will the three of you?
Hi, my name's Anne. I'm calling from Milford, Massachusetts. I'm a special ed adaptive health education teacher. I have worked with this on this issue with special needs students, including students with Down syndrome. And I really think that it's a part of growing up with a disability that people overlook. Intimacy is important for all of us, not just a sexual relationship, but a close relationship with someone that we care about who cares about us.
That's great. Karen, it sounds like some special ed teachers have seen this before.
It sure does. I'm sure that this isn't a new issue to people who work with persons with disabilities or their parents. One thing I would like to say is that, you know, one of the things our organization tries to focus on is empowering people with disabilities. And I guess to us, empowerment it means being able to make your own choices and making your own choices, whether they're good or bad, because that's how we all learn,
right,
whether we have disabilities or not. And that would be one bit of concern I have about this, is I'd really like to see Otto be able to sort of naturally go out there and develop a relationship just like anybody else who doesn't have a disability.
Well, Otto, before we go, and Lucy, help us here, has Otto come close to his goal here?
Also, have you had a girlfriend?
I have one girlfriend. It was called Hannah Evans.
But you've had... It's very sad because the girls with Down syndrome who Otto has dated, very often they've been treated like children and their parents haven't let them have a relationship. And he tries to have relationships with ordinary girls and they're just, you know, beyond a kiss and a cuddle.
Beyond a kiss and a cuddle, that's right. Getting beyond a kiss and a cuddle, that's the mission. You know,
yes.
I want to thank both of you for spending some time with us. Lucy and Otto Baxter. Otto's a 21-year-old man with Down syndrome. Lucy is his mom, trying to get him more than a kiss and a snuggle. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Karen Avery, thank you for giving us your perspective. Karen Avery, Associate Director of Independence First from the Center for Independent Living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And more of you are weighing in here.
My name is Dawn Morningstar, and I was calling in as a young person. And I think that as a 21-year-old, it was more important for him to have a physical relationship because as a young person, that's really all we're thinking about. And companionship is really important to us and to everyone. But I think that because of our hormones and age level we're at and it's really important for us to have physical relationships because that makes us at least feel like we're having companionship too.
That's great. That's from that demo, and here's what this listener had to say.
I think the young man said it. It's his decision, what he's looking for. It's not ours to decide what's appropriate.
Now, this is from another listener. She wrote in and said, as a sibling of a woman with Down syndrome, I've observed this firsthand. Speaking about her sibling, she said she's living with her boyfriend of many years in an apartment, and that's the good news. The bad news is that she was raped 30 years ago by an earlier, quote, boyfriend. Sexuality among people with disabilities was a controversial issue then and now. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And your takeaway today comes from Tehran.
Obama has made a radical departure from Bush and, for that matter, other U.S. presidents because they always try to sort of split or to differentiate between the Iranian people on the one hand and the Islamic regime on the other hand.
You should podcast that interview. That's Sadek Zubakalem, political science professor at Tehran University, talking about President Obama's video last night addressing the people of Iran. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chideya. This is The Takeaway.
Happy spring.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Obama on The Tonight Show, bowling for political kudos. He shoots, he scores.
I bowled a 129. Yes, I had. Oh, no, that's very good. Yeah. Oh, that's very good, Mr. President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
Oh, great. A Special Olympics joke. Nice bowling there, Mr. President. After all the disabled people who voted for you, this is the payback. Nice. In a damage control statement, a White House spokesman said, the president thinks that the Special Olympics are a wonderful program that gives an opportunity to shine to people with disabilities from around the world. Hey, forget bowling. Want to try some pickup wheelchair basketball, Mr. President? Laying down the GIMP gauntlet on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
I'm serious. Good morning. It's Friday, March 20th. I'm John Hockenberry. That'd be good. Pick up wheelchair basketball game.
I've thought people with disabilities were supposed to be extra nice until I came in and worked with you.
Only we can say the G word, okay?
I'm Farai Jadea, in for Adora Udoji, who's off spending time with her new child. Coming up this hour, the ghost of Northern Ireland's violence are walking the streets again. We'll preview a compelling new film, it's amazing, that looks at characters from another time in Northern Ireland. All that and more ahead right after these headlines.
Besides The Tonight Show, President Obama is also taking to the screen to make an unusual appeal to Iran. He's putting out a video message that appeals directly to the Iranian people.
The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities. And that place cannot be reached through terror or arms, but rather through peaceful actions that demonstrate the true greatness of the Iranian people and civilization.
There's already reaction to the president's Iran-Persian New Year message. President Ahmadinejad, a spokesman for President Ahmadinejad, says the U.S. must first recognize past mistakes if it wants to engage Iran. And in Afghanistan, neighboring Iran, there's heavy militant activity in both of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Pentagon reports U.S. and Afghan forces killed more than 30 militants.
In Pakistan, security forces are hunting for attackers of a base in the country's northwest. Rocket attacks killed 10 and injured dozens more. Pakistan suspects Taliban fighters in the strikes, and don't blame me, that's what AIG's old CEO was telling the press. Hank Greenberg says the company didn't have a bonus program for the financial division when he ran the firm. The current AIG head told Congress that the bonus program was already in place when he got there.
Well, whoever came up with the bonuses, Congress is still trying to get them back.
You disgust us. By any measure, you are disgraced professional losers. And by the way, give us our money back.
That's North Dakota Democrat Earl Pomeroy during debate on a bill to tax bonuses. The Senate has a similar bill, and it will move ahead next week. The S&P and the Dow slipped more than 1% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 784. So what did you think of the president's performance on The Tonight Show?
I would say that those individuals who criticize him the most are probably the same individuals who would have advised against his internet campaign. I thought he reached a broader audience, and I'm okay with that.
Are you okay with that? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's Barack.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Farai Jadea is with us one more day here. You know, I would like to title this segment, Say It With Faces, Hear It In Voices. The difference between a 5% unemployment rate and a 9% unemployment rate, that's easy. Four. The number four. But within that number are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of faces and voices of people whose lives have been changed in the midst of all of these shifting economic statistics, whether you're talking about bailout numbers or unemployment numbers or unemployment insurance numbers. We want to begin with faces and voices. And joining us now is Jason Reed, who is a former carpenter in Westerly, Rhode Island. Jason, thanks for joining us.
No problem. How are you?
Mark Dixon is here. He's a placement coordinator for Good Temps right here in New York City. He's in the studio. Mark, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And Tom Crawford joins us from Mineola, New York. He's a former paralegal. And what's your job right now, Tom?
Right now I'm doing some sales in the insurance field.
So you're working off pretty much commission at this point, right, Tom?
Yes.
Right. Jason, let me begin with you. Your employment circumstance has changed, and your living situation has changed. Can you tell me that story, please, Jason?
Yes. I was unemployed for several months and fell behind on my rent. And my landlord, sent me a subpoena to go to court. So I went to court, and I didn't have any legal representation, and I pretty much got, pushed around into signing a contract saying that I'd have to be out of my house within 5 days. And so then we went and stayed with a friend for a couple days, and we talked to this lady at the warm shelter here in Westerly, and she put us up here at the Blue Star Motel for a week or two.
So you're in a motel, but you're being subsidized by some sort of local income housing subsidy?
Yes.
Now, what was it like to tell your family where you were going from the house that you had to leave to the motel where you're in now?
It was kind of hard, you feel kind of bad about it, and, telling your friends and family that you have to, stay at a motel with your three kids.
How does that help you as you try to find another job, interacting with employers, people who, want to hire you?
I kind of don't really tell them where I'm staying. I just tell them, that I'm in town, and I have a cell phone, so I give them that phone number. That's about it, really.
Tom Crawford, any of this sounding familiar to you?
Very much so. A little bit on a different end, but it's been up and down the last number of years. I had a insurance small storefront brokerage business going that was going fairly well up until about the mid to late 90s. My wife took that over while I went back to school thinking about getting the my bachelor's degree, which I figured would help, and I did get that. I wanted to go back into the legal field. The trouble with the legal field is that it's been topsy-turvy itself. And it was one job after another, pretty much getting laid off due to restructuring. And then came the calamity of having to go on unemployment for a length of time, so I had no other choice but take whatever I could get. And
so, Tom, you should have gone into bankruptcy law. How much of a downturn in your income have you experienced in the last year?
It's... At one point, we weren't living high on the hog or anything like that, but boy, we went through all our savings within such a short time. It was unbelievable. It was actually scary.
Wow.
It's a consideration now where it's not, the unemployment's bad enough, the emotional and the psychological feelings. Every time you turn on the TV of hearing jobs gone down the tubes, can't even get a job at Home Depot for Pete's sake.
Mark Dixon, as the placement coordinator for Good Temps in NYC, right here in New York City, you see these faces every single day. Any new ones in the line looking for a temp jobs that you haven't seen before?
Yes, definitely. There are lots of new people coming in every day. We get people from all different disciplines, entry-level positions. We get a lot of people coming in, and they're all pretty much feeling the same way, that it's just something we've never seen before, and they're looking for the light at the end of the tunnel.
I want to jump in, Mark and Tom and Jason, and ask, if each of you could just give me a little bit on this, because I want to really hear from each of you. I have some friends who are saying that when they go for jobs after having done X, Y, or Z, they're viewed as overqualified for a position because people are afraid, if you've got X, Y, and Z degree or X, Y, and Z experience, you're not going to stick around. You're not going to give 100%. Mark, how do you sell yourself as someone who's really willing to do a good job if you're doing something that people might have thought in the past was, quote, beneath you?
Well, the thing is, you have to impress upon the potential hiring manager that even though you might seem overqualified, you're willing, able, and ready to work.
Tom, first, have you ever had any, moments where people start questioning your commitment?
I'll put it to you this way. I've been told by other agencies to cut down my CV because, like you said, I had too much experience. I also had the situation more than once where I'd interview, and it would be brought up that, it's an entry-level position, and, there were younger people. How do you feel working with somebody younger and all? And as Mark was just saying, I try to impress on him the fact that it's you know, that's no problem whatsoever. I can do the work, and I enjoy doing the work, and the idea is the work, not, you know, necessarily easily the relationships.
Now, Jason Reed, you're in a different situation. I'm wondering if being from the construction trades helps or hurts you trying to pitch yourself in another profession.
I would say it might kind of hurt in a way because, you know, being a carpenter for 15 years and, you know, then you're filling out applications at Burger King and stuff like that, I kind of think that they feel I'm not qualified to work there. And I just tell them that I'm willing to do anything at this point just to, you know, keep a roof over my family's head.
Damn it, that really, I mean, you got your family living in a motel, pal, and that doesn't qualify you to work at Burger King?
Right.
Get out.
Yeah, it's tough,
you know. The economy.
I think one of the most important things to do is sell your ability and your desire and your drive. You have to, you know, overlook all of these other superficial ideas, overqualified.
But employers have to get it into their heads that, you know, these people aren't desperate. They're willing to work, right?
Exactly.
Well, you can be desperate and willing to work and willing to do a good job. I mean, you know, right?
They go together. So Jason, let's back up a second. At what point does living in a motel stop being an adventure for kids and become a real sober kind of taste of reality for young people?
I would say when I had to, you know, transfer their bus, you know, from, they go to school in South Kingstown, and I was driving them back and forth to school every day. And I had to, you know, finally get bus transportation for them because I couldn't afford to drive, you know, back and forth twice a day all the way to another town to bring them, you know, to school and home.
So when that bus pulled up and everybody could see where they were coming from,
that was the
reality check.
Yeah, definitely.
Boy, I got a picture of that in my mind.
Yeah.
Man, so what's your day like today, Jason?
I have a few you know, places I'm going to go this morning and fill out some more applications. There's a welding job down in Hope Valley that I'm going to go apply for and, you know, just see where that takes me and look through the newspapers and, you know, just hit up every place I can and fill out applications.
Tom, you want to give us your to-do list today?
Yeah, pretty much the same. I will be going to the office, making some calls, trying to make the appointments, and you know, getting together to discuss policies with some people, and pretty much trying to keep the head above board and keeping a chin up more than anything else. Because boy, it's not easy.
Mark Dixon, you want to take us out?
I'd just like to say, Good Temps is committed to finding people jobs. We have some openings. I would encourage anyone out there that's interested in finding a job to come and register with us. We're 219 East 44th Street.
And there are temp agencies all over the country in the same situation as you.
Absolutely.
Right. And this is an option.
And Good Temps is a division of Goodwill, and we pride ourselves on our mission to place people with barriers to employment.
Mark Dixon, placement coordinator for Good Temps, speaking about New York City. Tom Crawford from Mineola, New York. Good luck to you, Tom. And Jason Reed, Westerly, Rhode Island,
certainly
former carpenter.
It.
I hope you get your hammer and nails working sooner rather than later, Jason. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Man, maybe we should go back to numbers.
You know what? People can survive. I believe it.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm Farai Chidea. So the president was on Jay Leno's Tonight Show last night.
Yeah, I ran for president because I thought we needed big changes. And I do think in Washington it's a little bit like American Idol, except everybody is Simon Cowell.
Wow. Wow. That's rough.
And this was the first time a sitting president has been on the show. What did you think of his performance?
Hi, I'm Phyllis from Charleston, South Carolina. I did vote for Barack Obama. And if he feels that he can go on The Tonight Show and other places, including the Internet, to get the not only the attention of the American people, but to create an awareness of what's going on and what he's trying to do, I say go for it.
So do you think it's good for his image, or is it a good way to get his ideas across to the public, or is it a good way to have some gaffes come across to the public? Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So does that mean John McCain got the Paula Abdul vote?
Ooh, yeah.
So look at a map, folks. Hop onto I-40 east of Knoxville, Tennessee, and you travel down the road to Route 34. Move a little bit north, take a left. You eventually hitch onto Route 11 and wind up in Morristown, Tennessee. It's a little town of only about 60,000 people, but it's also the setting for a look at the interesting relationship between the labor force brewing in this troubled economy, immigrant and non-immigrant workers competing for the same jobs. My guest, New York Times national immigration correspondent Julia Preston, focuses on Morristown, a place known for its manufacturing as much for its conservatism. In her Sunday Times News article, she's in the studio with us. Thanks for joining us, Julia.
Good morning.
Your piece is part of a series that The Times is doing on changing issues in immigration. And why did you pick Morristown?
Well, it's a town that has seen a large influx of Hispanic immigrants in recent years, a factory town in the middle of a rural Appalachian context.
What kind of factories?
Two kinds of factories,
yep.
Really. Auto plants, right. Plastics components, and then there's a whole swath of lower-wage factories making meatpacking
right,
and poultry,
right,
that
right.
kind of thing.
So, and all of them are experiencing difficulties. And what families did you find that typify some of the trends that market economists are attempting to sort out with some great difficulty right now?
Well, I ended up looking at two American workers and two illegal immigrant families. And one of the things that's quite important in the difference here is the buffer effect of the unemployment safety net. It has become quite stark in this downturn that American workers and legal workers have the option of, poor and overwhelmed as it is, of going to get unemployment insurance and get some help from the federal government to get it through. Whereas if you don't have legal immigration status, you cannot participate in the unemployment safety net, and they, most cases, illegal immigrants know this, and they're not trying.
So for conservative working-class Tennesseans in Morristown, they are in the social safety net, probably something that they maybe voted against during their, you know, many kinds of red state elections. And illegal immigrants are out of the safety net altogether.
Well, there in the past, until this recession started, there was a fit between the immigrant workers in this town and other American workers who, to a certain extent, were moving up in the manufacturing labor force. But now what's happening is that the illegal immigrants are really having to retreat from this community. It's really become much more a situation of hiding. And yet, even under those circumstances, they're quite reluctant to go home. The natural functioning of the labor market is not really working because in many cases, the immigrants have been there for a while. They own homes. Their kids are in school.
So they can't go back to Mexico.
Well, they're very reluctant. In many cases, they don't have families or stakes to go back to in Mexico. So this is building this kind of pressure in this labor market.
Well, you know, I just wanted to interject because what you're talking about is a story that you describe about a family, Enrique and Rita, who, you know, are not giving full names. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, both of them have been working in low-wage jobs in Morristown for most of the past decade. Their kids are in school. They're very proud of their kids going about to go to high school. Their situation now is both of them are illegal. They really have just retreated from anything resembling community life, but they are really clinging, especially Enrique, to the job that he has. He used to be a kind of a feisty guy, but now he's just determined to hang on to work. And if you multiply that, you get a potentially problematical situation where people are quite desperate to hang on to work, potentially lowering wages, that kind of thing.
Estimate of the percentage of immigrant workers in Morristown?
Well, the Hispanic population is now about 10% of the population. 10%.
So that's a huge number.
Let's talk
about on the non-immigrant side. What is the sense that there are competitions now for jobs with immigrants that didn't exist before? How does that manifest itself in middle-class citizen families?
Well, this was quite striking to me because you would think, and I went to Morristown thinking that there would be a lot of tension. In fact, there's not. In fact, the workers that have been hit by these rolling layoffs, it's really been quite impressive, are really focused on getting their unemployment benefits, looking towards the future. There's quite a bit of retraining. It's not great. It's really hard and terrible, but there's a different set of options. And by and large, the American workers are focused on, building their future. And there's a surprisingly little tension, I thought, in Morristown at this time.
Political changes for people suddenly relying on the government?
Well, that's an interesting thought. You know, I was really looking at working class people. And they have a long experience of having to rely on government assistance for retraining and that kind of things.
And that experience is going to continue. Morristown, East Tennessee. It's the setting for Julia Preston's story in the New York Times this Sunday. Julia Preston, New York Times immigration correspondent, profiling Morristown as a showcase for what's going on in the immigrant labor force in this economic downturn. Femi Okay is here with the headlines.
At 28 minutes past the hour, President Obama is back in Washington on his schedule today, a meeting with state lawmakers. He'll also discuss transportation with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Former AIG chief Hank Greenberg rebuffed claims by the insurer's current boss that he's to blame for the company's financial troubles. Greenberg spoke this morning on CBS's The Early Show. He said the retention bonuses that are the focus in Washington were not in place during his leadership.
We had a bonus plan based on performance. If you didn't perform, there were no bonuses.
So the current AIG CEO, Edward Liddy, criticized Greenberg's leadership under oath to Congress members earlier this week. Now, it is the first day of spring, so a good day to start thinking about some gardening. And the First Lady will be doing exactly that when she breaks ground on a new garden on the White House.
It's a picture in the Times this morning. It's really exciting.
Yes, the first time since Eleanor Roosevelt had the Victory Garden that there's been a garden in the White House.
It's a
brilliant, veggie garden.
Fabulous idea. And that's great soil down in Washington. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea. There's been much ado about President Obama's appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Last night, we finally saw 44 hit the studio floor.
I'm honored to introduce my first guest, the 44th President of the United States. Please welcome President Barack Obama.
All right, this is the first time a sitting president has ever appeared on The Tonight Show. It was a historic cultural-political mashup, and to help us understand it, we've got comedian John Frusciante, artistic associate at Upright Citizens Brigade, a theater in New York, and Julie Mason, White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Hi, guys.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So, okay, we can't avoid what some folks are calling the verbal equivalent of a stink bomb. Not lethal, but certainly.
Hey, it's making me mad. Come on, Mr.
Not
Wheelchair
cute.
Over here. Come on.
Well, I imagine the bowling alley has been just burned and closed down.
No, right? No. I've been practicing
really?
Bowling.
Really?
I bowled a 129.
That's very good. Yeah. No, that's very good, Mr.
This
President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
Special Olympics. Ouch.
Yeah. All right, Julie. overly folksy-itis getting in the way of sensitivitis? What's going on with that? And how much will he pay, if anything?
Well, even before the show aired last night, that was causing him trouble because it leaked out that he had said that. We got the transcript about an hour before he went on. So we all knew he had said that, and you know, people were reacting, and it's going to blow over. But he does have that tendency to make these little gaffes. It's kind of interesting to watch him do it.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that his comfortability led him. There were a couple of moments where he got so comfortable that he just started talking like he's a regular guy, you know, and these were one of those moments. But it's... At the end of the day, that's just a hacky joke. You know, I mean, he's the president. He's got to give us a new joke for that situation.
It's true. I actually thought the American Idol joke was worse.
Julie, what happens in a situation like that? Does the Secret Service go, okay, he's going down a bad road here, I mean,
exactly.
They have like a
we're
going
to have to body tackle him.
Yeah, definitely.
No,
I heard.
No, but I mean, you could feel his staff off stage just cringing and cringing when he did it.
Actually, I want to go to something totally different. We actually played a little bit about, you know, Simon Cowell earlier, but he had another one, and I want to get you, John, to rate this joke.
Okay. Banks or credit cards would lend you money so you would pay it back.
Right.
Now they lend you money so you can't pay it back. It's like we were talking before. I mentioned we all saw A Wonderful Life. Mr. Potter, the meanest man. Remember, he owned the whole town? You know what he charged on a mortgage? 2%.
He's like Mother Teresa now.
He's like Mother Teresa now. He makes Visa look like, oh.
So maybe it's that the president is better when he's just adding the spice, you know, backing up Leno's joke. Is that it, John? I mean, well, as a comedian, deconstruct the moments.
I think that the pop culture jokes hit the hardest last night, and I think that that's what people can identify with. I think you've got to give us more pop culture jokes, you know. Compare Geithner to Sam from Cheers. You know, he's got a bunch of wacky people around him, and he's just got to kind of make sense of it all. No wonder he's stressed out all the time.
It's a great pitch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
We wouldn't call it Cheers, though. We'd call it Hell.
I mean, that's kind of what's going on right now.
Well, Julie, I mean, you know, from your perspective, one thing that's happened is that pop culture has become part of the political remix. And how fair is it or smart is it for political reporters to pay attention to this as much as they would the State of the Union?
Oh, well, we couldn't. That just would never happen. We would never pay that much attention to it. It's interesting. He's done it. It's unusual. But, I mean, State of the Union is huge. The problem for Obama is he really is not a big consumer of pop culture. So when he goes on Leno, he ends up talking about tax policy. You know, this is the guy he is. He's not a really funny guy. He has said that he doesn't actually watch American Idol. So it's kind of a conundrum for him. He's a bit at cross purposes. He wants to appeal to this audience, but he doesn't really have the ammo to do it.
He's still got some laughs, still talking about tax policy. I heard some titters.
You know, he could get some laughs reading from the phone book. People just, they still love him so much. He's got a really high approval rating. People wanted him to be successful. Well, they're going to laugh at whatever he said.
The interesting thing about last night is that his delivery was more crisp and clear last night. A lot of times in the past, even the last time he was on Letterman when he was making jokes, you kind of had to pause for a second and realize, oh, that was just a joke. But in this appearance last night, his delivery was better. You could actually tell when he was setting up and making a joke.
Well, they joked a little bit about animal friends of the White House.
When is the dog coming? I keep hearing about the dog. It seems to me when was the dog supposed to be there by? Wasn't it? I thought it was like as soon as they moved.
Listen, this is Washington. That was a campaign promise.
Oh, wow.
That's a pretty good joke.
He's going to hear about that one.
Good.
That's
good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Julie, it strikes me that some people are going to pay attention to this because they already watch the show. Some people are only paying attention because people are saying that this is a watershed moment. It is a first, but is it a watershed moment, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's just the natural progression of things. At some point, a president was going to turn up on late-night TV, and Obama was just the first one. So I think we're turning a corner, but I don't think it's a great moment in the culture.
All right, but two questions. And Julie, David Gregory on the Meet the Press is toast. That is the headline this morning. And John Frusciante, could Obama do stand-up in the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater? Would you be giving him a call?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we would definitely give him as much time as he wanted to do stand-up, but you'd have to have people write jokes for him. And
would he be a monologist, though? A good monologist for your improv?
Well, as long as he brings his good delivery and not the dry stuff. You know, I'm sure he's got plenty of stories to tell.
Sketch comedy. There's more history to be made here. Julia, a comment on David Gregory. Is he toast?
Never toast. He's a bit of an English muffin.
All right, with that, we're going to exit stage left. John Frusciante, Julie Mason, thanks so much. John Frusciante is an artistic associate at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York, and Julie Mason is White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner.
I love those guys. They were great.
And now we have the great Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much, Bright. It's your last day. You don't have to suck up to me. 21 minutes.
It's so fun.
I know. Thank you. I appreciate that. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all.
So I still do?
Suck up to me?
Yeah.
When did you ever do that? When? Not even on my birthday. 22 minutes now to the top of the hour. Actually, 20 minutes to the top of the hour. President Barack Obama is reaching out to Iranians today in a tape message that seeks to mend decades of hostility. The video was released to news outlets in the Middle East, and it's time to coincide with the festival of Nowruz, which means New Day. It marks the arrival of spring. Israel's military launched an investigation yesterday into the deaths of Palestinian civilians during the country's three-week offensive in Gaza. Apparently, according to some soldier accounts just released, they suggest that care was not taken to protect civilian deaths. And police have arrested a top deputy in a powerful Mexican drug cartel. Vicente Zambada is now in custody. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning. John Fry.
So reviews of the performance on Jay Leno. Our guests gave it high marks in this segment. But what do you think? 8778 My Take or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I think he did pretty well. And
well, it's definitely one of those things where it's that whole adage like there's no such thing as bad publicity. I mean, I'm sure he did well in general. But even with the whole question of the Special Olympics joke, you know, people are still seeing him. Yeah.
Jay Leno. I don't know. He should do Meet the Press. Maybe that would help that show.
We'll be on 60 Minutes. He needs to come on The Takeaway.
That's right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Excitement is mounting in Angola, where Pope Benedict arrived earlier today. And this catchy jingle has been playing on TV there all week, welcoming him. All right, Papa, Pope.
Amigo.
Papa
Amigo, Portuguese.
Our friend, the Pope. Okay, more than half of Angolans are Catholic, as well as Portuguese-speaking, and they're flooding the streets of Luanda, Angola, where the BBC correspondent Louise Redvers is right now. Louise, you know, set the scene for us about what's been going on thus far.
Well, this morning, about 6 o'clock, people started to turn up at the airport here, 7 hours before the Pope's plane was due to land. And by the time he arrived, there must have been 5,000-6,000 people all singing, clapping, dancing, chanting that chant you just played, actually, Papa Amigo Angola está contigo, which means Pope, my friend, Angola's with you. So they were chanting and singing. He got off the plane, he met the president, he met the other diplomats, and then he came out of the airport, and there were huge screams as he went down in his Popemobile towards town, and thousands of people have now followed, literally running after the car to try and see as much of him as they can.
We talked about the growth of African Catholics, the population. Have there been popes who visited Angola before?
Yes, Jean-Paul II came in 1992 during a short ceasefire in the long war here. And a lot of people who I've spoken to remember Jean-Paul's visit, and it was a very special moment for Angola. But this time there's another Pope coming, so everyone here feels to have had two Pope visits is such a big deal.
When you think about Angola, is it seen as a good recruiting place for the Catholic Church? I mean, it seems to have quite a bit of following already, but is there still an expansion of Catholicism in Angola?
Well, Angola was the first place in southern Africa to receive Catholicism more than 500 years ago. And so from that point of view, there's a very strong, very structured Catholic faith here. Is it growing? Is it falling? It's hard to say. The church says between 55 and 60% people here are Catholic. There is an increase of more evangelical, sort of Brazilian-style churches, which are becoming more popular. But the Catholic Church is very central to people's lives here. They do a lot of pastoral work, a lot of social work. They provide a lot of health services. So from that point of view, I think people stay with the Catholic Church because they've always known them. And during the war here, which lasted for 3 decades, it was the Catholic Church who fed them, who gave them water, and who looked after them. So there's a huge loyalty. Here.
Well, Louise, you can really see in Angola that the era of affiliation with the Catholic Church and the colonial legacy of Africa has really been broken completely. I mean, John Paul accelerated that, and you're really seeing it with this trip by Pope Benedict, it seems.
Yes, I mean, the Pope is really... Everybody's just been so excited to see him, and it's been such an important visit. People have talked about nothing else for weeks, months, and, you know, the television's been talking about it. Today's a public holiday. Obviously, the weekend, there's lots of events. There's a big public mass for 2 million people on Sunday. Monday is likely to be a public holiday. No, this is a very important few days for Angola.
Oh, well, so glad to get this update. Thank you, Louise. And we have been speaking to Louise Redvers, a BBC correspondent in Luanda, Angola, where the Pope is today.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Hunger-striking Irish Republican Bobby Sands, The Body as a Weapon, and Northern Irish Politics, a new movie, Hunger. More about that after headlines with Femi Okay.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Getting some news in this hour of an American naval accident in the Middle East. The U.S. Navy says that two of its craft collided in the Strait of Hormuz today. The strait is just off Iran, leading to the Persian Gulf. The collision was between a submarine and a ship, and there are no reported injuries. The Navy is still looking at the damage. Dozens of militants are dead after new fighting in Afghanistan. U.S. and Afghan forces fought fierce battles in two parts of the country, and this wraps up a violent week that saw several Western troops killed. At home, the Senate has confirmed the nation's first female Solicitor General. Eleanor Kagan is currently Dean of Harvard Law School, and she will have the job of representing the U.S. before the Supreme Court. And finally, I'm going to end this newscast with a little bit of Vivaldi.
Oh, I know.
Spring
Sports
started.
Seasons, right? Yep,
yeah,
there we
this
go.
Is spring. The Allegro, the spring. Spring started just over 2 hours ago for us in the Northern Hemisphere. Today is also the first day of autumn, of course, if you live in the Southern Hemisphere. It's also the day that Iran kicks off the Persian holiday of Nowruz, or New Year.
So spring's a little Largo here in New York with the snow coming down.
A little bit of snowflakes.
Not Allegro at all.
Happy spring to you. Have a great weekend. I'll see you soon.
Yes,
thanks,
you too. Thanks, Femi. And I want to move on to another one of those moments where art, politics, and history collide. Back in 1981 in the United Kingdom, a group of men from the Irish Republican Army made headlines. They were imprisoned in a British jail in Belfast, Ireland. They said they were political prisoners, but Margaret Thatcher said otherwise.
Faced now with the failure of their discredited cause, the men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what may well be their last card. They've turned their violence against themselves through the prison hunger strike to death. They seek to work on the most basic of human emotions, pity.
Those words mark a turning point in Hunger, a film by artist and director Stephen McQueen. Hunger takes us through the last 6 weeks in the life of Bobby Sands. Sands and 9 other IRA members starve themselves in the brutal Belfast prison called The Maze. Director Steve McQueen is here with me in the studio. How are you doing?
Not bad, thank you.
Great Hollywood name there, Steve.
Mm-hmm. It calls for what Wikipedia calls disambiguation. So you are not an action star, but you did win the Turner Prize, which is an incredible prize that distinguishes you or distinguished you as a visual artist. Now you've moved into films that hit the screen. Why did you choose to do this movie?
Well, it sort of started, in fact, when I was 11 years old. And it's one of those situations where, religiously, 9 o'clock news, BBC 9 o'clock news, my family always used to watch it. And one day, an image appeared on the TV screen of a man, and underneath this image was a number. And I imagine I thought it was his age, this person, how old that person was. But the next day, the numbers increased, and therefore, I didn't understand it exactly. But then my mother told me this person had... is on hunger strike, and one of those things which has stayed with me, the whole idea that someone, in order to be heard, stopped eating, the whole idea of this oral situation where someone stops eating and gets louder.
We have, your film really doesn't pull a lot of punches about what the body does, and you have a moment where a doctor is describing to San's parents what's happening to San's body as he slowly starves to death.
He will have low blood sugar, low energy, and muscular wasting. He'll be experiencing gastrointestinal ulcers with the thinning of the intestinal wall and submucosal hemorrhaging. There will have been degenerative changes to the mucous membrane of the intestines and indeed all the organs in the body.
There are moments where this film is very hard to watch. Why did you choose to make a film that was that intense visually about the human body?
The situation is, during that period in time Watch protest and the blanket protest. There was only 90 seconds of actual image, film footage actually filmed. And it's just one of those situations where one had to sort of get involved with what actually happened there. And the only way I could have done that was to sort of actually film it. The sort of the smeared excrement on the wall, the urine on the floor, the way these guys live for 5.5 years, the only way one can do that is visually. And it's all about sort of using the body as a last result, as a form of process.
Stephen, Bobby Sands apparently believed from almost the beginning that he could turn his battle, his organic battle with starvation, into a global confrontation with the British government. As you put this film together, did you see how he did that, how he turned a very personal... hunger strike into a gigantic global political battle?
Well, it's one of those things where the strategy of that situation of hunger strike is, of course, it's a very interesting one, because what happens is obviously it takes time for the body to sort of break down, and it takes time for the body to sort of get in a situation where you are, in a COVID state and therefore eventually die. So the whole idea of this ticking clock, that process is very, it's a form of protest which is quite dynamic in the way that people are thinking of you while you are in that state. And as time goes by, it gets worse. So, the whole idea of negotiation, the whole idea of talking is still on the table. But of course, there's a ticking clock. So, quite a devastating way to protest, and obviously, unfortunately, an effective one.
One of the things that you also do very clearly in this film, and the Irish freedom struggle is something that is very controversial still, in a way that, for example, the end of apartheid, now we're like, oh, let's put a bow on Nelson Mandela's 27 years on Robben Island and just say, yay, equality. But there's still so much more anger and outright violence, as we're seeing, around the struggles in Ireland. But I want to get to transition from what you were saying about the body. There's also a struggle of the mind that you portray very clearly.
I'm down on my knees, and I take the fool's head in my hands, and I put him underwater. He's thrashing around a bit to start, so I press down harder until he's drowned. Priest arrives, though. He's grabbing me by the hair, dragging me through the woods, promising me a proper hiding. But I knew I did the right thing by that wee fool, and I could take the punishment for all our boys.
That is the actor Michael Fassbender as Sands saying, I could take the punishment for all our boys, talking about that discipline. But you look troubled, which other people won't see because, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think there's only you can't be angry forever. I mean, you know, there's a point where, you know, one has to sort of discuss and talk and have a debate about a situation because everyone loses otherwise. Everyone loses. And I think, you know, the case in point, of course, is the debate between Bobby and Father Dom in the film. This is a part of history, of Irish and British history, which, yes, happened. But I thank God it's in the past because, you know, one cannot go down that road in a way because it all ends in failure on both sides.
But Faulkner says the past isn't past, you know? Do you think that there is such a thing as putting to bed a conflict like
no,
this?
The
could
past,
it happen?
The past is always current, always present, absolutely. And that's why I made the movie. But there's a situation where one has to eventually learn from the past. Otherwise, you know, we're just sort of, you know, history does repeat itself. It doesn't seem we do learn from the past.
Well, it's this choice between death and life. Well, which is what makes this film so gripping. I mean, we got to go, but that's so amazing.
Well, you know, there's so much to say, and we will have some video of it, too. We have to say goodbye and thank you to Stephen McQueen.
Can I just one quick thing? I mean, the film for me is all about the reasons to live and the reasons to die, and we always have to make those decisions.
Well, it is an incredibly powerful film opening in New York today. It's also for folks not in New York City on demand on the IFC cable channel. It's opening across the country at different places in the coming weeks. And we have to thank the film's director, Steve McQueen.
It's great stuff. And there's one more question I had. You can find it on our website. Go to thetakeaway.org. President made history by showing up on Jay Leno's couch last night. We're asking, what'd you think of his appearance?
Going on Jay Leno was a great first step, but it's not nearly enough. Obama needs to have his own show. I think that would be what he needs to do to promote his agenda, to educate people, motivate people. He has to act as the instigator, agitator in chief to promote a really positive, progressive agenda.
I don't know if that's a demotion, having his own show, but keep that in mind,
Mr.
President. So I just want to take this moment and thank Farai Chidea, who's been sitting in for Adoree Udoji these past 3 weeks. It's been a really fun 3 weeks. Are you going to be back?
I would love to, and I want to, you know, thank you so much, thank the staff of The Takeaway, and thank News and Notes, which is having its final day. Thank you.
It's having its final day today?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't really. Goodbye, News and Notes. There is a breakfast for all on the Takeaway staff, so come on downtown and you can have breakfast with Farai Chidea. No, I'm in trouble. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.